Welcome, everyone, to the 18th live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. My name's Tammy Simon. I'm the founder of Sounds True, and I'll be your host for this session. In this session, Joe Dispenza will be teaching on becoming supernatural, how common people are doing the uncommon. Joe is broadcasting live from Olympia, Washington, while I and the Sounds True team are all here in our Boulder studio. Please note that a free recording of this session will remain accessible for 24 hours. If you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, along with bonus gifts from our presenters. And now it's my honor to introduce you to Joe Dispenza. Joe Dispenza is a researcher, lecturer, and New York Times best-selling author. He is an expert on the brain, mind, and human potential, and has taught thousands of people how to reprogram their thinking through neurophysiologic principles. His approach, taught in a very simple method, creates a bridge between true human potential and the latest scientific theories of neuroplasticity. He's the author of three books, including You Are the Placebo, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself and Evolve Your Brain. He's also featured in the award-winning film, What the Bleep Do We Know? Joe Dispenza, welcome to the Neuroscience Training Summit. I'm so glad you're bringing your voice and presence to the summit. Thank you.
Thank you, Tammy. I'm very happy to be with everybody. I think that this is a time in history where it's not enough to know. I think this is a time in history to know how. And because we're in an age of information, we can gain so much knowledge from so many different branches of science. And I think that the most important thing for people is to learn how to apply certain principles. And we learn different philosophical or theoretical or scientific information. And every time we learn something new, we make new connections in our brain. That's what learning is. Learning is forging new connections. And the Nobel Prize researcher Kandel in the year 2000 found that when people learn just one bit of information, they doubled the number of connections in their brain from 1,300 connections to 2,600 connections. But if they didn't review that information, if they didn't repeat it, if they didn't think about it over and over again, those circuits pruned apart within hours or days. So if learning is making new synaptic connections, then remembering is maintaining and sustaining those connections. And so then you learn information and you store it in a part of your brain called your neocortex. Neocortex is that walnut-shaped part of your brain where it's the seat of your conscious awareness. That's where you begin to interact with your environment, and as you begin to interact with your environment, you begin to upscale the hardware in there. So then you learn a bit of information. Now you learn a little bit of science. You learn a bit of knowledge, some theory, some philosophy. But your next step then is to apply that information, to personalize it, to demonstrate it, to initiate it in some way. And if you can initiate that information and you get your behaviors to match your intentions, or you get your actions equal to your thoughts, if you get your mind and body working together, you're going to have a new experience. Now, when you're in the midst of an experience, all of your five senses plug you into the external environment. And as your brain is gathering all this valuable sensory information, as all that information rushes back to your brain through five different sensory pathways, jungles of neurons begin to organize themselves into networks. The moment those neurons string into place, they reinforce the philosophical circuits from the knowledge you've learned. In other words, experience enriches the brain. But the moment those networks are assembled and organized into place, the brain makes a chemical. And that chemical is called a feeling or an emotion. Now, a brain right underneath the neocortex called the limbic brain or the emotional brain or the chemical brain begins to produce what's called neuropeptides. And those neuropeptides then are the molecules of emotion that cause us to feel. So the moment we feel like a leader, the moment we feel like a patient parent, the moment we feel abundant, The moment we feel the emotion from the experience, now we're teaching our body chemically to understand what our mind has intellectually understood. So we can say that knowledge is for the mind and experience is for the body. And in that moment, we're beginning to embody the truth of that philosophy. Now, the moment we feel an emotion from a new experience, science tells us that it's the environment that signals our genes. That's a fact. But by the same means, if experiences produce emotions from our environment, then it's the emotion that begins to signal the gene. So in the moment we begin to feel a new emotion, and we're teaching our body chemically to understand what our mind has intellectually understood, that new information in the environment begins to select and instruct new genes, and we begin to rewrite our biological program. We begin to signal new genes that begin to make new proteins. So we're beginning to change on a biological level, which means if you're embodying the truth of that philosophy and you've done it once, the question is, can I repeat the experience? And if you can repeat any experience over and over again, you will begin to neurochemically condition your mind and body to work as one. Now, if you repeat it enough times and your body now knows how to do it as well as your mind, or your body now has been programmed to be the mind, now it's innate in you. It's second nature. It's automatic. It's easy. It's familiar. In fact, you've done it so many times that you no longer have to consciously think about it. It becomes a subconscious program. So now we have just activated the third brain called the cerebellum, the seat of what we call implicit memories, things that you've done so many times it creates a habit or a skill. So when we get to that point where we're neurochemically conditioning our mind and body to work as one, we're beginning to master that philosophy now, and we're moving into a state of being. It's who we are. So our job then, really, is to go from philosopher to initiate to master, from knowledge to experience to wisdom, from mind to body to soul, from thinking to doing to being, and learning it with your head, practicing it with your hands, and knowing it by heart. And you and I have all the biological and neurological machinery to do this. And common people around the world literally are doing the uncommon. And so if you give people the proper information, and this is where my passion comes from, and I think that science has become the contemporary language of mysticism. I think science is what demystifies the mystical. And if you can combine a little quantum physics, the science of how mind and matter are related, the science of possibility, and you combine it with a little bit of neuroscience or neuroplasticity or some neuroendocrinology, a little bit about psychoneuroimmunology, how your mind and body are related, and a little bit about epigenetics, all of those sciences build a model about possibility. And so then if you can teach people the proper information, and as they learn that information, if they can turn to the person next to them and explain that information, the moment they begin to explain that information, they're describing a model of understanding. And as they review that information, and between the two of them, they build a sound model, they're firing and wiring new circuits in their brain to reflect the model that they're learning. And as they remind themselves of what they're learning, they're reproducing the same level of mind, and they're causing their brain to fire in a new sequence or a new pattern, a new combination. And whenever you make your brain work differently, you're changing your mind. So when students begin to share the information after they've learned it, they're creating more memories and they're assembling new neurological networks. Those new neurological networks become the hardware that they're installing in preparation for the experience. Now, why is that relevant? Because then if you can set up the conditions in the environment and give people the proper instruction, a certain percentage of those people will get their behaviors to match their intentions and their actions equal to their thoughts. They'll get their mind and body working together and they'll have some type of transformation. Now, my passion over the last 4 years, because we were seeing significant changes in people's health and their well-being, they were having tremendous mystical experiences in our workshops. I had to start measuring to see what exactly was taking place in people's brains, in their bodies, and in the energy in the room as well. So I assembled a team of scientists and researchers, and we have done probably 15 advanced workshops where we began to measure some of those transformations. Now, it's important to measure those transformations, and because if you can measure the transformation, now you have more information to understand how to teach transformation the next time. And if you could measure that transformation again and gather more information, you can teach transformation better the next time, and you can begin to close the gap between knowledge and experience. And for me, that's been my passion in the last 4 years. And we've done close to 9,000 plus brain scans on our students. They come to an event, and we scan their brain before they come to an event. They go through 4 days of intense training, from 6 in the morning till 6 in the evening. And it's not something that they are tortured in doing. They love doing it. Then we measure their brain at the end of the event, and we notice significant changes that take place. And I want to know that those changes are not just taking place in their mind, but those changes are taking place in their brain. At the same time, we're also measuring people's brains in real time. Now, the model that we use for transformation has everything to do with meditation. And why do we use meditation as the model? Because if you're waking up in the morning and you're coming back to your senses, and the moment you come back to your senses, because the brain is a record of the past, it's an artifact of everything you've learned and experienced to this moment. The moment you wake up in the morning and you're not being defined by a vision of the future, then you're left with the old hardware or circuitry of the past, which means you're probably going to be thinking in the past or thinking in familiar ways, and you're going to show up predictable in your life. By the same means, the moment you wake up in the morning and you search for the familiar feeling called you, the moment you get in touch with the feelings that are connected to the problems or the people in your life, because feelings and emotions are a record of the past, the moment we get in touch with that familiar feeling, our body is now in the past. So then if the emotions of our body are driving our thoughts and driving our behaviors, then for the most part, we're thinking and acting from the past. And if you believe that your thoughts have something to do with your destiny, then of course, if you're thinking in the past, you're going to be creating more of the past in your life. So we use the model of meditation because the moment the person wakes up in the morning and they come back to their senses, and as they see the same people and they go to the same places and they do the exact same things at the exact same time, it's the external environment that's turning on different circuits in their brain, causing them to think and feel equal to everything that they know. And as long as they're thinking equal to their environment or the people and the conditions and the places and the objects and things in their environment, as long as they're thinking equal to their environment, they keep reaffirming the same reality. And if they are having those certain emotions and those emotions are driving certain thoughts, and those thoughts then are creating the same emotions and the emotions are then are driving the same thoughts, and how you think and how you feel creates your state of being, then for the most part, people who get caught in these cycles of thinking and feeling and feeling and thinking over time condition their body to subconsciously become the mind of that emotion. So then we use meditation because to change then is to be greater than your environment, to be greater than the circumstances in your life, to be greater than the conditions in your world. And every great person in history understood this. So then in meditation, when you close your eyes and you disconnect from the external environment, and at the same time, you replace soft music in the background or you put earplugs in, you're diminishing the amount of sensory information coming into your brain. If you are then conditioning your body to be the mind emotionally, and it's in the habit of getting up in the morning and running through the same routine and doing the exact same thing that it did yesterday, Now the body's been programmed into a predictable future based on what it's done in the past. And let's just say the person's been doing that for 20 or 30 years. They wake up in the morning, they check their cell phone, they check their text, they check their Facebook, they check their emails, they check the news. They get up, they go to the toilet, then they get a cup of coffee, and then they get dressed. After they take a shower, then they drive to work the same way. They do the same things. They see the same people. They push the same emotional buttons. They eat the same foods. They watch the same television shows. And then they do their same routine before they go to bed at night. If they're doing that over and over again, and a habit is a redundant set of automatic, unconscious thoughts, behaviors, and emotions that's acquired through frequent repetition. A habit is when you've done something so many times, the body's been programmed to be the mind. And for the most part, people's bodies are programmed into a predictable future based on what they've done in the past. And very often, they're not in the present moment. So then if you were to sit your body down and tell your body it's no longer the mind and it's not eating anything or tasting anything or smelling anything or experiencing anything, so it's not feeling anything, then for you to sit your body down then and find the present moment, then you'd have to be greater than your body and to be greater than time. And meditation is the perfect tool that we use to do this. So then if you're going to heal your body by thought alone, if you're going to create some new event in your life by thought alone or some new future that's not the same as your past by thought alone, then you have to be defined by thought alone. And so then our students then have been instructed and taught how to change their brainwaves and in a meditative state move into those altered states of mind so that they can begin to get into the operating system where those subconscious programs exist. And so we've measured people in real time during meditation, and we know that our students can change their brain waves in 4 seconds or 5 seconds or 9 seconds or 12 seconds. They know how to regulate internal states. And I wanted to see during the meditative process what was going on in the inner workings of their mind and their brain. And so we've done thousands and thousands of scans in real time during meditation, and I can tell you that your brain doesn't change your brain. I can tell you that the personality doesn't change the personality, that the ego takes a long time to change the ego, that matter takes a long time to change matter. That when people are truly, truly present, there comes an elegant moment where they get beyond themselves, that they take their attention off their body, off of people and objects and things and places in their environment, and they forget about time. And that is the moment that they begin to become pure consciousness. That's the moment that consciousness becomes the epiphenomenon of matter. And so in the scans that we've done, in looking at people's brains in real time during meditation, we've seen very, very profound changes in everything from anxiety to depression to cyclic mood disorders to traumatic brain injuries, which hopefully I'll show you as we get going here. And I was interested in looking at what happens during the meditative process. So we've done a lot of real-time scans, and I can also tell you that when you analyze your life within some disturbing emotion, and those emotions are derived from the hormones of stress, that as long as you're living and feeling and thinking within those particular emotions, you're going to make your brain worse. We've seen it hundreds and hundreds of times in people. Because as you analyze your life within some disturbing emotion, and emotion is a record of the past, you're thinking in the past. And of course, the answer lies when you get beyond your past emotions. So we've also partnered with HeartMath Institute. We've done thousands and thousands and thousands of HRV, heart rate monitor, scans to see how people can regulate elevated emotions and sustain those emotional states, because in our work, we know that when you combine a clear intention with an elevated emotion, you're changing your biology from living in the past to living in the future. And so we want our students to be able to create coherence in their brain. And of course, we now know what it takes to do that. And we want them to create coherence in their heart. And when the heart begins to function in a more coherent manner, and a person can get in contact with elevated emotions like gratitude and inspiration and kindness and compassion and invincibility, that the heart starts beating more regularly, more rhythmically, in coherence, and it begins to create a measurable magnetic field. It's actually the strongest organ that produces that magnetic field. Well, that magnetic field is an energy. It's a frequency. And all frequency carries information. And so when the student lays their intent, their thought, on the carrier wave of that energy, they begin to send a new electromagnetic signature into the quantum field. So we want our students then to be able to sustain those coherent states in their brain and the heart. We've measured the energy of the room, the measured energy around people's bodies, the energy centers of their bodies. We've measured epigenetic changes in their urine, in their saliva. We've measured their immune responses, their cortisol levels. And recently we've measured 7,500 different gene regulations in a handful of students to see if they're actually regulating, signaling new genes right in real time during our event. So my passion then, of course, is demystifying the mystical so that people have within their reach all of the tools to begin to make measurable changes in their lives and in their health. And so when we started seeing healings and changes taking place right during our events, it was time to start doing the measurements. Now, the topic of this particular lecture has everything to do with becoming supernatural, because after a period of time, we noticed that people, when they went deep enough into a meditation, they seemed to go from a somebody to a nobody, from someone to no one, from something to nothing, from somewhere to nowhere, and from some time to no time. They became pure consciousness. And if they could linger as an awareness and learn how to become comfortable in the unknown, then all of a sudden they would start to feel more whole and less separate. And the unified field, the quantum field, is the field of information and energy that governs all the laws of nature. And you and I have all the biological and neurological machinery to connect to it. So then as we begin to unfold into this field as a consciousness, we start to feel more whole. We start to feel more oneness. We start to feel more connected. And our biology begins to reflect that with coherence in the brain, coherence in the heart, the upregulation of genes. The biology is getting an upgrade. And so when we start venturing deeper into this field of information, we start to experience going from a somebody to nobody to everybody, from someone to no one to everyone, from something to nothing to everything, from somewhere to nowhere to everywhere, and from some time to no time to every time. And people start to have very profound mystical experiences. And in the mystical experience, the interesting thing about it is that they're having a full-on sensory experience without ever using their senses. And whatever's happening between their ears is more real than anything they've ever experienced in their life. So why is that important? Well, if you have a full-on sensory experience without using your senses, right now, if your senses were heightened by 25%, just say, for example, everything you were seeing, everything you were hearing, everything you were smelling, everything you were tasting, everything you were feeling. If your senses are heightened by 25%, so is your awareness. And if your awareness is heightened by 25%, then so is your consciousness. And if your consciousness is heightened by 25%, you can't have consciousness without having energy. So the energy in the brain should be heightened as well. And we started getting these measurements, and we have many, many students that have a profound mystical experience that's very subjective. And since experience enriches the circuitry in your brain, and experience produces an emotion, in 1 second, they begin to connect to this field, and in a sense, their past literally is washed away out of their body, because as the circuits begin to reorganize to reflect the experience, and the emotion of awe and wonder and freedom and love is being created in their body, that new emotion then from the inward experience a lot of times is greater in intensity than any past trauma, any past betrayal, any past shock that branded them emotionally to keep them anchored to the past. So My research has been all about uncovering that mystical experience, and I want to talk a little bit about some of that and show you some brain scans. So we think 60 to 70,000 thoughts in one day, and 90% of those thoughts are the same thoughts as the day before. So let's go to the first slide here where it says how to change your reality. If you look here, if you're thinking the same thoughts, you're always going to make the same choices. As you make the same choices, you're always going to demonstrate the same behaviors. If you keep reproducing the same behaviors, you're going to keep creating the same experiences, and the same experiences are going to create the same feelings and the same emotions. Those same feelings and same emotions are going to drive your very same thoughts. And your biology, your neurocircuitry, your neurochemistry, your hormones, and even your genes are going to be equal to how you think, how you act, and how you feel. So the principle of neuroscience says that nerve cells that fire together wire together. If you keep thinking the same thoughts, keep making the same choices, keep demonstrating the same behaviors, keep creating the same experiences and producing the same feelings, you're going to begin to hardwire your brain into a very finite signature. And that finite signature, by the time we're 35 years old, becomes our identity. That is the box in the brain that we talk about, and it becomes the person's most common way that they behave, the way they think, and the way they feel. So now they're programmed. But if you give people new information and they study that information and you teach them how to do something with it, a new thought should lead to a new choice. A new choice should lead to a new behavior. A new behavior should create a new experience. And a new experience should create a new feeling or a new emotion. And that should inspire new thoughts. And of course, that's called evolution. So getting people from one state of mind into another state of mind is going to require them doing something. So then the redundancy of thinking the same way, of making the same choices and feeling the same way, how you think, how you act, and how you feel is called your personality. And your personality creates your personal reality. That's it. That's the story. So look at the next slide. It says your personality creates your personal reality. So your personality is your state of being. So now, if we could just click on it again, it says, if you keep thinking the same old way, you keep acting the same old way, and you keep feeling the same old way, then your personality and your personal reality will be exactly the same. So then teaching people then how to change the way they think, begin to make new choices and demonstrate new actions and behaviors, create new experiences that then produce new feelings and new emotions, sooner or later, their new personal reality will be a reflection of their new personality. And I think the biggest challenge is that most people try to create a new personal reality as the same personality, and it doesn't work. So there's a concept in neuroscience called metacognition. And because of the size of the frontal lobe, we can think about what we've been thinking about and change it. We can become aware of our unconscious habits and behaviors and modify them. And we can look at the emotions that have kept us anchored to the past and decide if those emotions belong in our future. And I think the biggest challenge is that many people are afraid to step into the unknown, and so they stay the same personality wishing for a new personal reality, and it doesn't work. We literally have to become someone else. So then to change our personal reality, we have to change our personality. So let's take a look at the next slide. This is the difficulty about change, because the hardwired patterns that are taking place in the brain and the emotional conditioning that takes place in the body becomes very comfortable, becomes very familiar, it becomes very predictable. And our old biology then is pretty much anchored in the past. The hardest part about true change and transformation is not making the same choice as you did the day before. So then the moment you say, I'm going to wake up early in the morning and I'm going to work out, or I'm going to do a meditation every morning, or I'm not going to eat sugar, or I don't know, you're going to go to bed early and wake up early. The moment you make that decision to do something like that, you better get ready, because to some degree you're going to feel uncomfortable. And that is the moment the body steps into the unknown. And so most people, when they step into that unknown, it feels uncomfortable, it feels unfamiliar, it feels uncertain, there's some unpredictability involved. And if they've conditioned their body to be the mind, the body starts sending signals back to the brain and it starts saying to you, you know, you can't do this, it's too hard, start tomorrow, you're not good enough, you're too much like your mother, this doesn't feel right. And that's the body beginning to activate circuits in the brain that cause us to think in the same old ways. So if we start thinking the same way, the same thought leads to the same choice, the same choice leads to the same behavior creates the same experience produces the same emotion. And most people say, oh, this feels right. No, actually, that feels familiar. So going from the old self to the new self, stepping into that void, stepping into that unknown, is the biological, the neurological, the chemical, the hormonal, and even the genetic death of the old self. So people step into that unknown and they say, I can't predict my future. Well, the best way to predict your future is to create it, not in the known, but in the unknown, which means then, what thoughts do you want to fire and wire in your brain? What behaviors do you want to demonstrate? The act of rehearsing your behaviors and planning your actions, when you're truly present and truly focused, the brain will not know the difference between what's going on out there and what's going on in here. So then your brain begins to look like that behavior or that experience has already occurred. Now your brain's no longer a record of the past. Now it's a map to the future. And of course, then the next question is, can I teach my body emotionally what this future is going to feel like before it's made manifest? Which means you don't wait for your healing to feel whole. You don't wait for your success to feel empowered. You don't wait for your wealth to feel abundant. You don't wait for your new relationship to feel love or the mystical moment to feel awe. That's the old model of reality of cause and effect, you know, waiting for something outside of us to change how we feel inside of us. And when we feel better inside of us, we pay attention to whoever or whatever caused that. And that event is called a memory. The quantum model of reality is not about cause and effect, it's about causing an effect. That means the moment you start feeling whole, your healing begins. The moment you start feeling worthy and free and abundant, your wealth is being drawn to you. The moment you start falling in love with yourself and falling in love with life, you'll create an equal. The moment you start feeling empowered and inspired, you're moving towards your success. And the moment you're in awe of life, you're going to have a mystical experience. Now that's causing an effect. So that's kind of turning the program around, because most of us are waiting for something outside of us to give us relief from our pain or our emptiness or our lack. And we teach our students how to emotionally embrace that future before it happens. So then why is the river of change so important? Because most people would rather hold on to their guilt than step into the unknown. They'd rather hold on to their fear than take a chance in possibility, because they can't predict that future. Well, if you're in the process of creation and being defined by a vision of the future, then it means you believe in your future more than you believe in your past. And you can teach people then how to really cross that river. So the fundamental question is, can you believe in a future that you can't see or experience with your senses yet, but you've thought about enough times in your mind that your brain is literally changed to look like that future has already happened? The latest research in plasticity says it's absolutely possible. And can you select a new possibility, a new future potential that exists in the quantum field, and begin to emotionally embrace that future before it's made manifest to such a degree that your body as the unconscious mind begins to believe it's living in that future reality in the present moment, and you begin to signal new genes in new ways so your body begins to change to look like that future has already occurred? Latest research in epigenetics says it's absolutely possible. So then think about this. If there's physical evidence in your brain and body to look like the future has already happened, physical evidence in your brain and body, then it means then you get to relax, because now the event is going to find you. And it will come in a way that you least expect. And why does it come in a way that we least expect? Because if we can predict it, anticipate it, or expect it, it's nothing new. It has to surprise us. It has to catch us off guard. It has to prove to us that what we're doing inside of us is producing some effect outside of us. And we can make the correlation between the change we've made inside of us and the effect we produced outside of us, we're going to pay attention to what we did and we're going to do it again. And that's called human empowerment. So then students then are going from living as a victim in their life to becoming the creator of their life. So then if you're a victim to your life, then your personal reality is reminding you of who you are as a personality. To be a creator of your life, you understand that your personality then has to continuously change to begin to line up with a new personal reality. And we use so many different ways for people to arrive at that means, but I can tell you that it's absolutely possible. So next slide says information to transformation. We are interested in teaching people how to marry a clear intent by gathering the proper knowledge and information and making their brain work better in a more coherent way. And we also know that when people live by the hormones of stress, and stress is when your brain and body are knocked out of homeostasis, that when you're living by the hormones of stress, of course, you narrow your attention on objects, on matter, on people and things, on your external environment, on your body, and you obsess about time, because that's where the danger is. So the primitive nervous system kicks in, the autonomic nervous system turns on the fight or flight system, and now your senses are heightened, you're defining reality as a materialist, and of course you're looking for the danger in your outer world, and of course your brain waves go into what's called a high beta pattern. And in that high aroused state, no new information can come into the nervous system that's not equal to the emotion the person has experienced. So the problem is, as you try to predict and control everything in your life when you're under stress, because stress means you can't predict or control an outcome, the moment you try to predict and control an outcome and you start shifting your attention from one person to one thing to one problem to one person, every one of those things has a neurological network assigned to it in the brain. So then as the brain is aroused, it's juiced up by those cocktail of stress hormones, and your brain is shifting from one thought to the next, the brain starts firing incoherently. When the brain fires incoherently, you fire incoherently, or you're not thinking well. And so we teach people how to take their attention off of matter, off of objects, off of things, off their body, and begin to go from a narrow object-centered focus to more of an open focus. And as they begin to focus on nothing, on space, on energy, if they're no longer thinking and no longer analyzing, the brain waves begin to change. And the whole purpose of meditation is to get beyond the analytical mind. And what separates the conscious mind from the subconscious mind is the analytical mind. And so we'll talk about that in a minute. But we teach people how to create coherent brains. And of course, we also teach them, and they understand that when they're resentful or they're impatient or they're frustrated, their heart also beats incoherently as well. So then, is it possible then to train them to regulate their autonomic nervous system by changing their brain waves and by changing their heart coherence, so then they can begin to transform themselves and transform matter? And that's kind of the model that we use. Next slide. Quick little overview on brain waves here. Look at the top one there. It says beta brain waves. You can see they're pretty fast. Your brain's job is to create meaning or coherence between what's going on in your outer world and what's going on in your inner world. Most people function in beta brainwave patterns when they're awake. When they wake up in the morning and their brain starts making serotonin, they start to use their senses and they're integrating everything through their senses, and the brain's trying to process all that information into meaning. So they're sitting, they're feeling pain, they're tired, they're hungry, they have the light on, they're doing a few things, and the brain's got to deal with all that information. So brain waves in the thinking brain are pretty quick. When you close your eyes and you eliminate your external environment, as an example, your brain kind of slows down in brain waves because it's processing less information. So now you're in alpha. And alpha, instead of the outer world being more real, the inner world starts becoming more real. When your body falls asleep and your mind is awake, you move into what's called theta brainwave patterns. That's a good place to be, because if you've conditioned your body to be the mind and your body's asleep and your mind is awake, that means it's no longer the mind, and you can fall right into some pretty quick changes and reprogram those automatic programs. Delta, of course, is restorative sleep, and we won't have time to get into gamma, but I call gamma superconsciousness or super awareness. That's when the brain is aroused, but instead of because of some predator or some threat in the environment, the brain is aroused because the sympathetic nervous system is switched on and it's and it's releasing energy instead of out of the body up into the brain, and the person's really has all their attention on the inner experience. So check this out. This is a chart of brainwave development. Children between the first couple years of their life, their brainwaves are very slow, about 0.5 to 4 cycles per second. But take a look at the theta brainwave patterns. They're a little bit faster, 4 to 8 cycles per second. Alpha is a little bit faster, 8 to 13 cycles per second. And then you have three ranges of beta brainwave patterns. You have low-level beta, which most people are relaxed and they're paying attention. If they have to take a test and they have to pay more attention, the light bulb in their brain goes on a little brighter and they move into mid-range beta. But when they're angry and they're frustrated, they're intolerant, they're judgmental, they're critical, they're depressed, they're anxious, their brain moves into high beta brainwave patterns. And the brain now is over-aroused. Now, the problem with this is some people get stuck there. And, of course, when they get stuck there, they need something outside of them to change their state. They have to take drugs or they have to drink alcohol or whatever to try to sedate their brain and body. But we can teach people then how to slow their brain waves down so that they can enter the operating system. So next slide, let the circle represent your mind when you're born. And when you're born, you're totally subconscious mind. So let's click on a few of these, and we learn by these positive-negative identifications and associations. And a good example of positive identification is when you're young and you cry out and you get fed, you learn to associate crying out with being fed. A good example of negative association is when you put your finger on the hot stove and you feel pain. The moment you feel pain in your internal environment, you're going to wake up and pay attention to what caused it in your external environment. And of course, keep clicking. That's how you create what's called habits or behaviors. Somewhere between the ages of 6 and 9, you begin to develop your analytical mind, your critical mind. And most children's brainwaves change right around 6 to 9 years old. They move into alpha. And the analytical mind separates the conscious mind from the subconscious mind. Conscious mind is about 5% of the total mind and brain. It's made up of things like logic and reasoning, which gives rise to our creativity, our will, and our faith. Just keep clicking here with me. And the subconscious mind is made up of 95% of who we are, and it's all these different habits and behaviors. So then our job then is to get beyond the analytical mind, which is always thinking and analyzing good and bad, right and wrong, positive and negative, male and female, past and future. And when the brain is aroused by the stress hormones, it becomes overly analytical. That's when we go into high beta. And of course, then people get stuck in these patterns of thoughts and feelings. So the whole purpose of meditation, next slide, is to get beyond the conscious mind, get beyond the analytical mind, and begin to change these self-limiting programs into more positive ones. So keep clicking with me here. And of course, in order for you to do that, you're going to have to get beyond your thinking brain. So next slide. Some people have a very thin veil between their conscious mind and their subconscious mind, which makes them more suggestible to information. They can begin to enter the operating system and make a change. Next slide. Some people have a little bit thicker analytical mind, like me, which means it takes a little bit more work for us to get beyond ourselves. But there are techniques that we use to teach people how to do that. Next slide. We could say then that the more analytical you are, the less suggestible you are to information. The less analytical you are, the more suggestible you are to information. And your suggestibility is your ability to accept, believe, and surrender to information without analyzing it. And that thought then slips right past the analytical mind and begins to program the autonomic nervous system to begin to make physical and biological changes. So we teach people how to increase their level of suggestibility through the act of meditation so that they can accept the thought that they are worthy, that they can accept the thought that they're healthy. And of course, if they're feeling negatively and they're saying, I'm wealthy, I'm wealthy, I'm wealthy, I'm wealthy, or they're feeling unworthy and I'm saying I'm wealthy, I'm wealthy, of course, that thought's never going to make it to the body because the mind and body are in opposition. You teach the person how to create more elevated emotional states, then they'll accept, believe, and surrender to the thoughts equal to their emotional state. And they begin to program their autonomic nervous system into a completely different destiny. And of course, that's the work that we're doing when we're measuring genes as well. The next slide says getting beyond the analytical mind. So you can see that high beta is very top of that brain and mind. And then as you begin to slow your brain waves down, you got to cross the analytical mind and you move into alpha, theta, and ultimately into delta. And you got to cross that analytical mind to get there. So next slide, beta goes to alpha, alpha goes to theta. Keep clicking, theta goes to delta. Beta and alpha represent the conscious mind. Alpha, theta, and delta represent the subconscious mind. So again, in teaching people how to regulate their brainwaves, we know by measuring it that there are things that work better than others. And of course, we're always improving our techniques, but we know now that in fact it does work. Next slide. So this says the movement of consciousness. So then as you begin to slow your brainwaves down, consciousness falls out of the thinking neocortex, and now you're entering the subconscious parts of the brain called the limbic brain and the cerebellum. Now, why is that relevant? Because that's the seat of your autonomic nervous system right in there. So then as you begin to drop a suggestion or a thought or an intention in there, the autonomic nervous system is the automatic nervous system. It says, I know how to do this better than you. I'm keeping you alive, and I'm your connection to life. And just let me heal you, and you just get out of the way. So teaching people how to slow their brain waves down and enter that limbic brain or the autonomic nervous system, of course, creates measurable changes in the brain. The autonomic nervous system steps in when the person has gotten beyond themselves, and all of a sudden you see more brain coherence and heart coherence, because its job is to create coherence and homeostasis and balance in the body. Next slide. When we measure brainwaves, we're not just after any type of brainwaves. We're after coherent brainwaves. Coherence is order. It's rhythm. It's cadence. It's synchronization. Incoherent brainwaves are like a group of drummers that are all beating their drums at the same time with no rhythm. There's a disorderliness that takes place in the brain and the heart. So then, next slide. A laser is a great example of coherent collimated light, and it's very powerful. And the lights that you use in your house, the incandescent lights, produce very incoherent waves. They're not organized, and they're not in rhythm. So, next slide. When we live by the hormones of stress, and we're shifting our attention from one person to one problem to another person to another thing to another object to another place to another problem, as we shift each one of those thoughts from one to the next, we notice that the brain begins to fire very incoherently. And the person is really obsessing about objects in their environment, or people in their environment, their body, how they feel. They become selfish. So then to get a person to move into more coherent brainwave states, they have to stop analyzing and thinking, and they have to slow their brainwaves down. And we're not just interested in any type of alpha brainwave patterns or theta brainwave patterns. We're interested in organized alpha and theta. Now, why is that relevant? Because the moment a person gets beyond themselves and they become nobody, no one, no thing, nowhere, and no time, they become pure consciousness. That's the moment their consciousness begins to connect to that autonomic nervous system. And if they're not thinking and feeling in the same way, and they're kind of vacant or vacated, all of a sudden what happens is, and other researchers have measured this, the energy moves right into the heart. The person starts to feel more in love with life, more whole. The heart then begins to send a very efferent, strong signal to the brain. The brain starts getting amplified. It becomes more coherent. The autonomic nervous system says, okay, he's gone or she's gone for the next 10 minutes or 15 minutes, and it begins to create coherence. So then different compartments of the brain that were once subdivided or no longer working in unison start to hold hands. They start to form bigger networks. They start to form bigger communities, bigger neighborhoods. And of course, all of a sudden, we see this on our brain scans where the person is truly connected. The front of the brain starts talking to the back of the brain. The right side of the brain starts talking to the left side of the brain. We start seeing this kind of psychic union going on between the two hemispheres. Now, the union of polarity, the union of duality, the union of opposites, And when the brain comes together as oneness or wholeness, and the person all of a sudden starts to feel an incredible amount of love or wholeness. They feel so whole, they feel so in love with themselves and so in love with life, that it's actually impossible to want. You can't want when you're at this level of wholeness. And we've seen it over and over again that when this starts to happen, people really feel tremendous, tremendous grace, and they feel connected to something bigger than them. And we've looked at them during their meditations, and there are tears of joy rolling down their face because they feel profoundly connected to an energy that's much bigger than them. And I call that the natural state of being. And so my interest then is that process. So next slide. Coherence we call health. Incoherence is disease. It's imbalance. And of course, coherence should be able to consume incoherence. And so according to the quantum model of reality, my understanding is that all disease is a lowering of frequency, an incoherent signature. And so then, next slide, if you were to lay a coherent energy over an incoherent signature, sooner or later, coherence will begin to consume incoherence. And of course, that is a healing. So, next slide now. This is the best way that I can describe coherence. Let each one of these metronomes represent a neurological network in the brain. When we're living by the hormones of stress, the brain fires very incoherently. And of course, each one of those neurological networks firing incoherently is causing the brain to fire incoherently. But if we keep our attention in an open state instead of a narrow state, coherence will consume incoherence. It's just the way it works. So watch over time, you'll begin to see those different networks beginning to form more orderliness, or those metronomes starting to work more in unison. And that's exactly what happens in the brain. The analytical mind, the critic, the default mode network in the brain tends to shut off. And when that happens, the brain starts firing more in balance. So you can start to see coherence consuming incoherence. And you see, as it keeps going, there's more coherence, and coherence is consuming incoherence. Now, if you look at the second metronome on the far right, behind the first one, you see that one is out of order, out of coherence. But if you keep practicing and keep opening your focus, coherence sooner or later consumes incoherence. It's the law. And so watch what happens over time. That coherence of the entire brain will ultimately gather more neurological networks in the same exact fashion. And that's coherence right there. And that's exactly how the brain works when networks begin to fire in unison. When the brain is coherent, you're coherent. When the brain is working right, of course, we're working right. And it's the same exact thing with the heart. Next slide. So then we measure with quantitative studies brainwave patterns as well. And let's go to the first slide where it says hyperactivity or hyperarousal. Quickly, if you look at this slide, you see that it's, don't panic. It's a simple slide. I just want to show you a few things here. Well, the first top left one is delta, then theta, then alpha, then beta, and then all those bottom ones represent high beta. When we see a lot of red in the brain is overstimulated, it's over-aroused, and the thicker the red line, the further away from normal we go. So this is a person that would have, for example, a lot of anxiety, or different compartments in their brain are changing channels very quickly. Next, if you click again, you'll see the hypoactivity in the brain. When you see a lot of blue in the brain, there's not enough energy in the brain, and so different compartments of the brain don't talk well to each other. If you don't see any blue and you don't see any red, that's normal. Of course, the thicker the blue line, the further away from normal we are. Now, next slide, take a look at this person here. And you said it says before meditation, you could see that the whole brain, the back of the brain, the nose is pointing towards the top, is in red, which means the brain is hyperactive, it's over-aroused. And if you look at the frontal lobe, the forebrain, the blue area, the boss, the CEO, the executive, there's no energy in the frontal lobe, which means the frontal lobe's turned way down. So if the CEO or the boss is gone, the rest of the brain's having a party. Take a look at the brain after meditation. This is after 3 days of meditation. This person had severe anxiety, and within 3 days, their anxiety diminished significantly. Next slide. Another person with anxiety as well. You can see all that red in the brain. 3 days later, there's hardly any red in the brain. They healed themselves of anxiety, especially that bottom row, second row, that represents high beta. Take a look at the right side. There's very little red in there, which means the brain has been tuned way down from that hypervigilant state. Next slide. This is a person with Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's disease is deficiency in dopamine in the brain. When there's not enough dopamine in the brain, the upper motor neurons can't communicate with each other. So this person then has a severe upper motor neuron activity, which means the brain is really overfiring. Take a look at her brain just a few days after 3 days of meditation. There's hardly any red in her brain. She started having a significant reduction in her Parkinson's symptoms. Now, when the upper motor neurons are not working together, people have involuntary tremors. They can't control their body. Try as they may, as they'd like to, but it's not under their voluntary control. But all of a sudden, she started changing and regulating her internal states. A lot of her tremors diminished. Now, next slide, it says standard deviations. Take a look at the slide after that. Don't panic. This is just a quick overview. Each one of these individual circles represents a different frequency of, in the brain. So the one says on the top, 1 hertz, 2 hertz, 3 hertz, 4 hertz, 5 hertz. So the first four represent delta. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 is theta. And of course, above theta, 9 to around 12 or 13 is alpha. And then, of course, we have beta beyond that. What I want you to know is that when you see a lot of blue, the brain's turned way down. When you see a lot of red, the brain's turned way up. And when you see green, it's normal. So take a look at the next slide. This is that same person with Parkinson's disease. You see all that blue and alpha and beta? She has problems with learning. She has problems with memory. She has problems with streams of consciousness. She has problems with language. She has problems with moods. Now take a look at her brain. If we click the slide again, there's a lot of green in the brain there. That means the person has moved back towards balance. The red in the bottom right-hand corner of the right side, that red represents anxiety. We told her, oh my goodness, that's anxiety. And she said, you know, when I'm anxious, my tremors get worse. So we said, okay, let's 3 days of meditation. You're improving your brain. Your symptoms are diminishing. Let's keep you doing your meditations. We'll take a look at the next slide. On May 9th, if you click again, you see even more green in the brain. And the red is diminishing, which means she's overcoming her anxiety. Now, on June 3rd, if you look at that scan, her mother died the week before, or 2 weeks before, and her sister had a stroke, and she had to leave town and take care of her affairs, and so she stopped doing the work, and you can see the right-hand side on the bottom, the brain is really red again, which means her anxiety came back. Next slide. So we said, don't worry about it. Just get back to doing the work after you, you know, take care of your personal affairs. And on June 27th, of course, her brain starts to improve again. And then by July 13th, she has an even better brain. And this person, more than 90% of her tremors from Parkinson's disease has gone away just by thought alone. Pretty significant. Next slide. This is a person with a traumatic brain injury. He went through the windshield of a car. His son was driving. His son died instantaneously, and he is wheelchair bound. All the blue in the brain represents there's no energy in the brain to control the body. Take a look at his brain. Next click. You see all that blue after meditation. He had a significant change in his health after this. Next slide. If you look at the traumatic brain injury here on the QEEG study, you see all that blue, just like the person with Parkinson's disease in alpha and beta. Problems with language, problems with happiness, problems with creativity, problems with learning, problems with streams of consciousness, with working memory. The next click, if you look at his brain after meditation, almost the entire brain is green after 3 days. This person has bladder control now, bowel control, and he's got a lot more mobility in his body just by thought alone. So next slide. This is CEO of a major company in Phoenix, Arizona. She's an attorney. She's a mom. She's having a lot of problems with her thoughts. She's having intrusive thoughts. The red on the right side of the brain in the back represents the pictures she's seeing. The orange on the left-hand side represents her talking about it. If you click again, you see the brain is completely green. Now, this person healed herself of anxiety just by thought alone. So I'll cover two more slides, and then we'll open it up for questions. Look at February 20th. You can see all the red in high beta there. And then take a look at February 23rd. You see, my goodness, there's no red in her brain at all. We ask her to keep doing her meditations, keep doing the work. We scan her on April 8th. Take a look at the next slide. There's no red in the brain at all. This person has healed themselves of anxiety. Next slide. This is February 20th and February 23rd. This is the high beta range of 21 to 30 cycles per second. That's a lot of red in the brain. That's a lot of anxiety. 3 days later, high beta, all that energy has been diminished in the brain. Final slide. Look at her brain on April 8th. That's high beta. Just from meditation, she was able to heal her anxiety by thought alone. So what I'll do now is I could go on for, I have more slides, but I want to open it up for questions so that we can spend the remainder of the 25 minutes that are left in, you know, answering a few questions. How does that sound?
That sounds perfect. Joe, thank you so much. And if you're interested in asking Joe Dispenza a question, there's a dialogue box under the video player. You can just type your question in and hit submit. And your question will come right here to me in the Sounds True studio. And we've already received several questions. One thing, Joe, you talk about meditation. Is there a specific type of meditation that you think is the most effective?
Well, you know, I don't subscribe to any particular practice of meditation that goes along with tradition or culture or religion. I take what works from a scientific standpoint. And so we have several different meditations that we do use. And those meditations are designed specifically for a person to get beyond themselves. And then once they get beyond themselves, to begin to change the way they think and to change the way they feel. So we probably have, I don't know, maybe 25 different meditations that are designed to create more coherence in the brain, to create more coherence in the heart, to create a new future, to signal new genes in new ways, to change a belief or a perception, to tune into a possibility that already exists in the quantum field, to activate the pineal gland. I mean, we just have a lot of different meditations, but I don't subscribe to any one particular belief or traditional practice, because I just take, for the most part, what works, and I just keep building a model from it. So I think if you just go to the website and you check it out, you'll probably come across one that will fit for you.
We have a couple of questions here about how long do you think people need to meditate daily to see coherence and brain change? That's a question from Jenna. And a related question from Susie, who writes, in hypnotherapy, we suggest that it takes approximately 21 days for a new neural pathway to begin to take form or a new habit to be created. What are your thoughts on time frame?
Well, I've changed my beliefs and thoughts about it significantly just because, I mean, we've witnessed so many amazing things. I have seen people transform in one experience. I mean, they have an inward experience that's more profound than any external experience they've ever had in their life, and as I talked about earlier. So there's a lot of variables. I think new neural pathways can be created in 21 days. I think they can be created in a short amount of time, and sometimes it takes a longer amount of time. Hell, it's taken me sometimes months to be able to change something about myself because it requires how present you are, how well you can regulate and change your brainwaves, how long you meditate, your focus and your concentration, your downright ability to be able to sustain a state. So there's so many variables involved that it's difficult to lock in a time frame. But I think that people who even spend 20 minutes a day in meditation, me, I spend more than that because I like it. I like the way I feel when I do it. I never like to get up from my meditation until I feel like the person I want to be. In some days it's easier than others, and other days it takes me a lot of effort. But the key is that I know when I'm there and I know when I'm not. And I typically don't get up, even if it takes me an hour or more, until I've gotten beyond myself. And so the technology that we use and the teaching tools that we use allow people really to practice with a 20-minute meditation or an hour meditation or an hour and 20-minute meditation or a 45-minute meditation. To me, it's just like anything else. If you're present and you're aware and you're conscious and you're all in and your energy is right, it will be easier than if you're laying down in bed and, you know, you're half into it. It doesn't work because, you'll fall asleep or you're not present or you're distracted. And I think there's just too many variables. But we know in some of the work we've done is that I've been more surprised, I think, than anybody. We've seen it happen in just a day or two in some of our advanced workshops because people come ready. And we're in and out of meditation all day long, and I'm attempting to move a community of people from one state of mind into another state of mind and really just get them to believe in how unlimited they are. And a lot of people lock into that. So it could happen in 4 days. It just depends on a lot of different variables. But you can meditate as much as you want. It's just that for me, the time isn't as important as the quality in which you do it.
Now, Joe, you mentioned sometimes you'll meditate an hour or more until you're in a certain kind of space, a space where you're beyond the self in some way. Can you describe that space to me? Oh, you know, you're there because it feels like, what's it like?
Yeah. So let's say what it's not. How's that? Because once you realize what most people do, and you know, look, people wake up in the morning. Where you place your attention is where you place your energy. That's the law. So you wake up in the morning, you start thinking about the emails you have to check and the shopping you have to do and the meetings you have at work and the people you have to respond to in your texts and the places you have to go. The moment you start that process, your body's being drawn into that future because that's where your attention and your energy is. If your attention and your energy is in the past and you're feeling discouraged or unhappy or unworthy, then if your attention is on your emotions, then your energy is in the past. So then finding the sweet spot of the generous present moment is a labor that requires you becoming conscious of when you're not present. So people, when they're sitting and doing their meditation, they're thinking about their coffee. When they're drinking their coffee, they're thinking about their shower. When they're in the shower, they're thinking about what they're going to get dressed, what they're going to wear. When they're getting dressed, they're thinking about the emails they have to check. When they're driving to work, they're thinking about, you know, the things they have to do at work. When they're at work, they're thinking about vacation. When they're on vacation, they're thinking about work. No one's ever in the present moment. So when you connect to the present moment, you will forget that you have a body. You won't have any attention on your body. You won't be emotional. You won't be frustrated. You won't be wanting to get up and do anything. You won't be caught up in an analytical cycle. And the distinction between when you're there and when you're not is the practice in and of itself. So you can only talk around that concept because you have to actually practice it enough times. So I know when I'm not present. And because I know when I'm not present, I know when I am present. And when I am present, it's no different than hitting a tennis ball in a sweet spot. I'm relaxed, I'm poised, I'm connected, my breathing slowed down, I'm feeling whole, I'm feeling empowered, I'm feeling joyful, I'm feeling free. And that's the moment my body finally relaxes into the present moment. So then when it starts thinking about where it has to go or what it has to do, and I become aware of it and I return it back to the present moment, I'm tempering the animal. I'm tempering the body. Then it starts getting emotional and frustrated and impatient. Now I know I'm in the past. My brain waves are going into beta, high beta. I stop. I return back to the present moment. I'm training an animal to sit and to stay. And if I keep doing that sooner or later, there's a liberation of energy. That's the best way I could describe it. We go from particle to wave. We go from matter to energy. And when that occurs, you feel less separate and more connected to something bigger than you. And the side effect of that is that wholeness that I'm talking about. You start feeling more whole or more in love with life. And I call that the natural state of being. So all the things you thought you wanted, when you finally arrive at this place, you no longer want because you feel like you already have them. That's when you're no longer in lack or duality or separation. So I think it's something that we talk around, and I think the application of doing it enough times causes us to know when we're there and when we're not. And I think, you know, many people, you know, they don't want to work that hard to find the present moment. And so because they don't work that hard for it, they're not really present. And it's a skill. The more you practice it, the better you get at it. And if where you place your attention is where you place your energy, and you have a lot of attention in the present moment, you have a lot of energy in the present moment. If you have a lot of energy in the present moment, then you got a lot of energy to heal. You got a lot of energy to create a new future. You have a lot of energy for a mystical experience. And we've measured the energy field around people's bodies. And of course, they're emitting more information. They're emitting more light. They're more wave. They're more energy and less matter. And of course, they feel more alive, they feel more vital, they feel more free. It's just that elevated state that I think words limit to some degree.
Now, just to connect this for a moment, Joe, to your discussion about coherence at the level of the brain and at the level of the heart, is it possible to subjectively know internally when we're coherent at the level of the heart and at the level of the brain? And how does that connect to the present moment experience that you're describing right now?
Oh, I love the question. Let's see how I can say this in the simplest of ways. When a person has gotten beyond themselves and they're no longer with their attention on their body and they become nobody, no longer their identity, they're not their name, they're not their gender, they're not their diet, they're not their profession, they're not a mother or father, they're no one. When they get beyond the things they own or the places they have to go and they get beyond time, when they become pure consciousness in that realm, if they do that properly, energy will, we see this, the moment that happens, the heart starts getting very coherent. The energy starts moving in the heart. And so now they start broadcasting a broader electromagnetic field. So now the heart's feeling more coherent, so they're feeling more in love. They're feeling more free. The heart then has a direct channel right to the brain, and all of a sudden the brain starts getting more coherent. But at the same time, when they're nobody, no one, no thing, nowhere, and no time, the different compartments of the brain that have been subdivided, they start to synchronize. And what syncs in the brain starts to link in the brain. So all of a sudden, you start getting this familiar feeling. It's a very familiar, unfamiliar feeling where you feel like you're connected. And so then when we do this properly, we're changing our state of being. We're creating a feedback loop between the brain and the heart. The heart is kind of our connection to the unified field. It's our center of oneness. It's the center of wholeness. So then when a person starts feeling that, it's not where they're feeling it with their body, because emotions like guilt and suffering and pain and anger and frustration, that's energy. Emotions are energy. Those are slower frequency energy. So it's lower emotion, causes us to feel more dense, more like matter. The elevated emotions are more energy and less matter. So then when we get to this point, there's a lightness that's created. And I think, you know, we measure this on our students. So we can tell them the moment they're connecting. We just had a great experience with one of the physicians that were at our event that had eczema since she was 3 months old. And all of a sudden, her brain went into super coherence in gamma, her whole entire brain. And the scientists that were measuring her thought she was having a seizure, but I had seen this before. And she was so connected and so profoundly moved by this energy of love, not chemical, but electric, that within one day, the next day, she sent us a picture of her arm that had eczema all over it for her whole adult life. Now, remember, she's a physician from London, you know, does all the diet and all the cortisone creams and everything. And then the next day, there's no eczema on her arm anywhere. She got the upgrade. She's experiencing a greater level of wholeness. So that level of connectedness then causes us to feel less separation from everyone and everything. We feel connected. We feel more at one with everything. And from my experience now, there's always greater degrees of this, because as we move deeper into this unified field, we'll experience greater orderliness or wholeness or oneness. So, but the best way that I can describe it is that it is a very intense electric feeling that is like nothing I've ever experienced before. That's when I really nail it. Now, there are degrees of that where you just feel elevated and you feel connected and you can focus your attention, that you can open your heart. It's easy. You can flow with it. That flow, that ease, is something that we're interested in more than anything else.
Very good. Joe, Lynn writes in, you mentioned technologies that you use. Do you use or recommend binaural beats technology or variations on it?
I like binaural beats. I like anything that helps to create coherence in the brain and alpha brainwave patterns. But I always say the same thing. I don't subscribe to the idea that once you create these alpha brainwave patterns that you're going to be healthier and your life's going to be better. And I just think that it's a way to get there. Now, once you're there, then it's up to you to direct your attention and your intention to an outcome, whether you're healing your body, whether you want to create a mystical experience, whatever you want to create in your life. In order for you to heal your body, you got to get beyond your body. In order for you to create something new in your environment, you got to get beyond the memory of your problems in your environment. If you want to create some new future time, you got to get beyond your schedule and time. And so when we see people finally enter this state and now they're there, now they can direct their attention. So we use some of the music, although we do a lot of live music at our events also that has a lot of that kind of coherence in it, patterns in it. Create coherence patterns. But I think that once you're there, then you still got to do the work. So I think it's a great tool, but I don't think it's the end all.
Joe, in terms of creating health when someone has an illness, or let's say creating greater wealth, if that's somebody's goal, there are so many examples, I think, of people who have attempted such things. They've attempted to go into a very open space and intend for their body to heal or for hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to pour into their life, and it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. What do you think are the core obstacles? Why doesn't it happen so much of the time?
Wow, and how much time do I have? Well, let me say this, that many people try, many people force, many people try to control, many people fight for it, many people hope. I mean, hope is a beggar. That we try to create from separation. And that means that people who say, I want to be healed, or I'm working on my healing and I hope I'm healing, or I hope I'm going to be more abundant, or I have the job of my dreams, they're actually still the old personality. They haven't become the person that they want to become. I know this because I've done it thousands of times. We return back to the common thoughts and emotional states and habits that keep us as that old personality. So then people, they work on creating their abundance, but then the moment they come back to their senses or they're creating their health, and the moment they feel the pain back in their body, they're still not getting beyond their memory of themselves. So the number one reason, as far as I'm concerned, why people don't create the future that they want is because of those survival emotions, those stress emotions. And when people live by those addictive emotional states, they are separate from their dream. They're separate from whatever it is they want. So they're trying and hoping and wishing and forcing without becoming it. So the act of overcoming to become something else is really what it's about. It's not about your wealth. It's about who you become. It's not about your health. It's about who you become. And I think there's not a lot of support in the world for us to do this. I think that we've been conditioned and hypnotized into believing we need something outside of us. But the students in our work that do it, and we have enough now to say that it's very possible, they understood that it took them 4 years to create their health condition because they had a really bad run for 4 years. They're gonna work on their health condition for 4 years, and they're not gonna complain, and they're not gonna get impatient, and they're not gonna struggle. They understand that they have to regulate and signal new genes, and they can't get up as the same person who sat down. They understand what it takes because they've studied the work. And yeah, it took them 2 years or 3 years to heal their cancer and all their other conditions, but they did it, and they never missed a day. And they had days where they didn't feel like doing their meditation. They did it anyway. They had days where they had a lot of doubt because the doctor told them they were going to die. They did their meditation anyway. They had days where they were in a lot of fear because their values went up in one area, and they got beyond their fear. And they had days where, you know, they didn't believe in their future. But they never stopped doing the work. And, you know, many of them said, I'm going to teach my body emotionally how this future is going to feel like before it happens. Now, that's the work, because now you're teaching your body emotionally what that future feels like. If you can understand and assign meaning to the fact that that emotion is going to signal the gene, by you intentionally doing it, you're going to produce a greater outcome. So, it's not easy. If it was easy, everybody was doing it. But I can tell you now without a doubt that common people around the world are doing the uncommon, and they want their future more than they want their past. They're more in love with their future than they are with their past, and they're uncompromising. They walk it, they sit as it, they lay down as it, they stand as that person, they practice being that person. And gosh, I mean, there are people in our work that were living in the back of a car, and now their business is worth $50 million. I mean, they just never gave up on their vision. And I think that it's an infection. You know, I think just like a an infection creates a disease amongst the community. I think that health and wellness and abundance is as infectious as disease. And you see a person stand up and tell their story about how they healed themselves of a MS or lupus or cancer or Hashimoto's syndrome or chronic pain or whatever. And they tell the story from start to end. And they're not a vegetarian, and they don't wear all white, and they're not muscular and skinny, and they're not in their 30s, they're in their 60s. And it didn't go exactly the way they wanted to, but they never gave up. And you get the real life understanding of it. And then you see the brain scan and the HRV monitor, and you see the changes in oxytocin levels or immunoglobulin A levels, and we put that all together. The audience has to start saying, well, God, if it happened to her and she doesn't look much different than me, it could happen to me. And that's exactly what's happening. So you have people with rare genetic disorders that medical science said you're never going to heal. It's just impossible that heal themselves. And person hears that person's testimonial and then they heal themselves of that condition. And I think that there's just not a lot of evidence yet. And when it becomes normal, which is what my hope is, then we're not relying on things outside of us to really heal and to change. We have all the tools. And there are people that don't, but their quality of life improves or something else changes. And I just think that we're just going to get better at it over time. That's all.
As a final question, I know that one of the things you teach when it comes to creating something in the future has to do with feeling gratitude and also like it's already here in a certain kind of way. It's already here. And I wonder if you could share a little bit about that just as an ending note for people who are listening and how that works, why it works.
Well, I can. I think that we only accept, believe, and surrender to thoughts that are equal to our emotional state. We never accept, believe, and surrender to any thoughts that are not equal to our emotional state. And accepting, believing, and surrendering, as I said, is your level of suggestibility. So then a person can say, I'm wealthy, I'm wealthy, I'm wealthy, I'm healthy, I'm healthy, I'm healthy, with their 5% of their conscious mind, and the 95% that's been programmed and hardwired and conditioned subconsciously is in a different program. It's saying, I'm in lack, I'm unhealthy, I'm unworthy. It's the thought never makes it past the brainstem to stimulate the body. So then we don't pray in our work to have our prayers answered. We get up from our meditations as if our prayers are already answered, which means then if you teach a person how to regulate and sustain a state of gratitude for 40 minutes, and our students, many of them can create heart coherence for an hour and sustain it. They know how to do it. They're in a state of gratitude, in a state of appreciation, in a state of thankfulness, in a state of inspiration, in love with life, a joy for existence. We want them to be able to do that. Well, if you're in a state of gratitude, when you give thanks for something or you're in a state of gratitude, it usually means you're getting something. So when you get something, when you receive something, that's when you give thanks and you feel gratitude because you got something and it's fulfilled some lack that you didn't have. So then if you're giving thanks ahead of the actual experience, your body as the unconscious mind does not know the difference between an experience in your life that creates an emotion and an emotion that you can create by thought alone. So the body's believing that it already has exactly what the person is intending. So then if the person is in a state of gratitude, they're going to accept, believe, and surrender to the thoughts equal to their emotional state, and they're going to begin to program their autonomic nervous system into a new future. So, of course, when we're in lack, we're in separation, we're in duality, it's difficult because our senses are fooling us into believing we don't have it, we're separate from it. So then that's why meditation is so important. We get a person in these elevated states, and they got to be able to sustain them. They got to trade anger for gratitude or compassion. They have to trade fear for strength or love or courage. And so then when they start expressing and feeling gratitude, it's not just gratitude. It's that whole package of emotions that go along with gratitude. So when the person starts to move into a state of gratitude, they believe what they're intending they already have. So now, think about this. You have a trauma, you have a crisis, you have a betrayal. The moment you feel the emotion from that crisis or betrayal or trauma, you feel differently inside of you. You pay attention to what caused it outside of you, and that event creates a memory. So then the memory becomes embossed neurologically in your brain. The emotion then signals the body, and the brain and body are in the past. So then when the person can regulate a state of gratitude, they're changing and elevating their energy and emotional state. They'll accept, believe, and surrender to the intentions equal to that emotional state. And in addition, if they're in that energetic state, they're in a state of receiving. Because the longer you stay in gratitude, the more you believe you already have it. So the art then is to get up from your meditation and to maintain that modified state of mind and body your entire day. That means if you do, something unusual should happen in your life. There should be feedback in your environment. It may not be the big experience, but you're getting information from the field that's letting you know to keep doing the work. So then the moment you start getting these synchronicities and serendipities, the energy from the coincidence then causes you to believe it's possible even more. So then you use that energy to create the next experience. And of course, we go from victim to creator. So we use the model of gratitude as one of the key emotional states, because gratitude is the ultimate state of receiving. So then when a person's in a state of gratitude and they're marrying that with their intent, the heart produces a strong magnetic field, their field is beginning to enhance, they're connecting to something greater, they're laying the intent, the thought on that energy, and now they're broadcasting new energy into the field. And of course, whatever you broadcast into the field is your experiment with destiny. So then they're broadcasting information into the field, and of course when there's a vibrational match between their energy and that future potential, they don't have to go anywhere to get it. It's going to come to them in some unusual way, and of course that's the art, to not be seduced by our senses, to not be seduced by the survival emotions, because the survival emotions draw from our visible field of energy and turn it into chemistry, and the field around our body shrinks. Now we feel more like matter and less like energy. So then getting people for 4 days or 5 days in a retreat and getting them going and getting them past their problems and their ex-husbands and their finances and all that stuff, once they get beyond the emotions of all those things and they're able to regulate internal states, they're going to do some pretty uncommon things. And of course, they're going to walk back in their life with their brain and body connected to a future instead of to a past. And then, you know, the magic starts to happen.
Very good. Joe Dispenza, thank you so much for being part of Sounds True's Neuroscience Training Summit. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Everyone, this concludes our 18th live session of the Neuroscience Training Summit. Thank you for your engagement and for the excellent questions. Tomorrow will be the last day of our Neuroscience Training Summit, and I hope you'll be able to join us. Again, the recording of this session will remain accessible and for free for 24 hours. If you wish, you also have the opportunity to purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, along with bonus gifts from our presenters. At Sounds True, we've wanted to make the Neuroscience Training Summit as accessible as possible, but I know that many people have missed some of the sessions. Perhaps due to a scheduling conflict, you might have missed one of the sessions that you actually wanted to attend. The good news is that you can own the entire downloadable library of 30 hours of teachings and practices. There's been quite a bit of detailed neuroscientific information shared during these 10 days, much of which bears repeat listening to really absorb the implications and begin to embody the changes in your life that are possible. If you're inspired to own the entire downloadable library of 20 training sessions, please click the button on this page. I've had the tremendous honor of being your host, along with my co-host, Christy Peoples, and I have to say that I've learned something new from each session. Again, I want to thank all of our presenters for distilling their significant leading-edge insights, and I want to thank each one of you for your participation. Our next live session will be with Eben Alexander and Karen Newell on the brain's role in filtering conscious awareness. This will take place tomorrow, March 29th at noon Eastern Time. Again, for Sounds True, my name's Tammy Simon, and thanks for being with us. SoundsTrue.com, many voices, one journey.